Penguin Random House Canada presents The North Star, Canada and the Civil War Plots Against Lincoln by Julian Scher. Read for you by the author. For Charles and Chloe, may they grow up in a world where justice and equality are cherished. Deep in our history of struggle for freedom, Canada was the North Star. So standing today in Canada, I am linked with the history of my people and its unity with your past. Martin Luther King Jr., speaking in Toronto at the 1967 Massey Lectures, 1 year before his assassination. Author's note. Language and the baggage it carries evolves as the politics of a society and the rights of its people progress. The terms Negroes and colored are used throughout this book when they are spoken by people or in contemporary newspaper accounts or in official titles, because they were commonly used during this period to describe Black Americans. In the 19th century, these terms were not necessarily seen as demeaning. Blacks themselves took pride in descriptions such as the colored regiments of soldiers. In contrast, what today is described as the N-word always had a much more derogatory and explicitly racist weight to it. In this audio version of the book, we mention its use when it appears in direct quotations in order to accurately reflect the hatreds and prejudices of the person or organization speaking. When the American Civil War broke out in 1861, the British colonies in North America were just 6 years away from becoming the Dominion of Canada under Confederation. In 1841, Upper and Lower Canada had been united as the British Province of Canada, made up of Canada West, what is now largely Ontario, and Canada East, Quebec. For the sake of convenience, the modern terms Canada and Canadians and the names of the provinces as they exist today are generally used throughout the book. In Quebec, many towns and streets that now have French names had English names, which have been kept in this book when referenced by the people at the time. Some quotations from diaries, newspapers, or other sources have been edited for minor grammatical or spelling mistakes. Prologue. Abe's contract was up. Mint juleps were available year-round in Dooley's Bar at the Swank St. Lawrence Hall in Montreal. The libations were served just the way the Southerners from the Confederate States of America liked them. Mint leaf, bourbon, some simple syrup and crushed ice, cold enough to allow a thin frost to caress the outside of the cup. When the handsome Southern gentleman walked into the popular hotel bar on St. James Street one evening in October, 1864, many of the patrons would have recognized him. Dark, curly hair, piercing eyes, an easy smile, and the confident walk that came from being an actor of considerable renown. A star of the first magnitude, as one glowing tribute had put it. A muscular, perfect man, gushed another. In the previous months, John Wilkes Booth had starred in performances in Nashville, Cincinnati, New Orleans, and Boston. But in Montreal, he stayed away from the stage. He told people he was in town on a pleasure trip, though in truth, he would spend a lot of time conducting serious business with Confederate agents and sympathizers who flooded the city. Perhaps the only person at Dooley's who was as well known as Booth, at least to the locals, was the stocky man with the neat brown hair who was standing by the pool table in the billiards room next door to the bar. Joseph Dion sported a handlebar mustache that drooped below his chin and seemed to come all the way up to his ears. The Quebec billiards champion was enough of a celebrity to have his picture on a cigarette trading card. I was introduced to J. Wilkes Booth, Dion later recalled, and indulged in a friendly contest of billiards with him in the saloon of that establishment, which was to continue to a late hour in the evening. There is no record of whether Dion was polite enough to let his American guest win. But it was the conversation rather than the competition that the billiards champion distinctly remembered about Booth. More specifically, the wild ideas he expressed. "Do you know, I have the sharpest play laid out ever done in America," Booth boasted. "I can bag the biggest game. Just remember my address. You'll hear of a double carom one of these days," ostensibly referring to the rare pool trick of sinking two balls at once. As the game and the evening wore on, Booth seemed to get more inebriated and more political. The American elections were just a few weeks away, Abraham Lincoln's political future, and the uncertain future of his divided country hung in the balance as the president fought for re-election. For 3 years, Lincoln had been waging a war against the slaveholding southern states that had broken away from the Union. His Emancipation Proclamation of January 1863, declaring that all persons held as slaves within the rebellious states should be free, divided the country even more. Booth, like most Confederate supporters, despised Lincoln and made his views clear to his Canadian host. Many months later, when his words took on a much more ominous meaning, Dion recalled Booth saying that it made damn little difference, head or tail, Abe's contract was nearly up. It was no accident that the man who would become the world's most famous assassin found himself in Dooley's bar just 6 months before he pointed his single-shot .44-caliber Derringer into the back of Abraham Lincoln's head. In Montreal, Booth was among friends. The St. Lawrence Hall was a notorious hangout for Confederate spies in a city that was a hub for wartime plotters, assassins, mercenaries, and soldiers on the run. A few hours' journey down a dirt highway or by slow train, Toronto was also a headquarters for Confederate moneymen and gunrunners. Canada in the 1860s was a country rife with espionage, a secret northern front in a civil war that was tearing apart its neighbor to the south. By early 1864, Jefferson Davis, the leader of the Confederate States, would order some of his most trusted aides to proceed at once to Canada to set up a well-funded Secret Service network. The Lincoln administration, in turn, sent its detectives and enticed snitches to Canada to spy on the spies. Today, Canadians take pride in having been on the good side in the battle against slavery, a refuge for 30,000 black men, women, and children who fled to what they would call the North Star of freedom on the Underground Railroad. That heroic endeavor is only part of the story. Much less talked about is Canada's own history of racism and the complicated role Canada played in the Civil War. The truth is that not all Canadians were cheerleaders for Honest Abe in his fight against the rebel slave states. In fact, with support from powerful men in the ruling elites, the country provided a staging ground for Confederate kidnap plots, firebombings, bank raids, and prison breaks. Shortly after Lincoln's assassination, Washington issued a formal proclamation explicitly declaring that the atrocious murder of the president was incited, concerted, and procured by rebels and traitors against the government of the United States harbored in Canada. Five of the six alleged conspirators named in the indictment were operating out of Montreal and Toronto. The sixth man, Jefferson Davis, was still in America. He was imprisoned after the defeat of his Confederate army, but once released on bail, Davis immediately fled to where many of his Confederate compatriots had already found refuge, Canada. He received a hero's welcome. The echoes of the war to end slavery still linger today in both America and Canada. Many books about the Civil War focus mainly on the powerful politicians and generals, inevitably all men. The North Star, however, is about ordinary people who chose a life-altering path as they stood at history's crossroads. Some choices were made for them by their circumstances, the place of their birth, their
Sample complete. Ready to continue?